from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's Next Forum Hour, in the age of Beyonce, hashtag Yes All Women, and Hillary Clinton's presidential run, it's tempting to say that feminism is thriving. But Andy Zeisler, co-founder of Bitch Media, is worried that the political movement has turned into marketplace feminism, full of what she calls empowertizing. In her new book, We Were Feminists Once, Zeisler argues that modern feminism is less about beliefs and identity and more about products and celebrities. She'll join us to discuss what she sees as the commercialization of feminism and what it means for women. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. We're joined in this forum hour by Andy Zeisler, who is co-founder of the magazine Bitch, Feminist Response to Pop Culture, and of Bitch Media. She's written for the Washington Post, the San Francisco Chronicle, Ms., Salon, and Mother Jones, and her new book is called We Were Feminists Once, From Riot Girl to Cover Girl, The Buying and Selling of Apolitical Movement. And welcome to the forum hour, Andy Zeisler. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to get right into the book here and essentially what you present as an argument, which I think is a pretty sensible and one that our listeners will want to respond to. Let's first talk about the word bitch, though. I mean, you probably hear a lot of talk about this, maybe even it's evolved. It's become biatch for many people. But it's one of those words that I think, like the N-word, it's used to the degree, or queer, that demystifies the bad or pejorative use. Do you go by that?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And queer was definitely something we acknowledged and certainly talked about when we were naming the organization way back when. Because that's a word that, you know, largely through work of LGBTQ activists around the AIDS crisis, was really able to be reclaimed in a powerful way. And we felt like, well, maybe the word bitch is ripe for that. That said, I would not say it's been hugely successful. But, you know, I think that it's certainly something that I'm glad people are still discussing in sort of timely contexts.
And still using as a pejorative. And still, I mean, it's actually come to mean as a verb, kind of kvetch, you know. It's not even gender bound. So.
Well, that was actually, yeah, the verb form was sort of what we focused on. And when we started bitch, we was like, there's an action component here. To bitch is to sort of speak up on something, to sort of try and make change. And that was exactly what we were doing.
It's a word that's often used about aggressive women, whereas I suppose with men, you know, and this is the gender divide, they're often called ambitious rather than being labeled with the B word, which kind of gets us right into a lot of what your argument is about. I mean, your argument really favors the importance of the feminist movement in terms of, should be an ongoing of great matter to people who call themselves feminists or believe in feminist ideology, gender equality, doing something about sexism and misogyny in a significant way, family leave, all of those kinds of issues. And what you're saying, in a sense, is they've been supplanted. They've been in some ways eroded by the popular culture, which you at one time were sort of an advocate of. You were writing about feminism.
Right.
You kind of gone through a conversion here.
No. I mean, I'm still very much in favor of, you know, popular culture as a real locus of feminist activism. You know, eroded is maybe not quite the way I would put it. I see it as sort of like two kind of parallel dimensions right now, where you have, especially with the rise of like internet culture and social media over the past couple of decades, the really radical and foundational dimensions of feminism as activism have become very apparent, have become much more outward facing and much more accessible to people. But at the same time, there's this very decontextualized, depoliticized consumer embrace of feminism. And of course, that's the one that's going to pull the most focus because it's louder, it's glossier, celebrities like it. It's not particularly nuanced, but it makes people feel good.
It's also cool, I think, is the word you use, right?
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, it's, you know, if you had told me 20 years ago that feminism was something that celebrities were going to be talking about on the red carpet, you know, in between talking about like their Spanx and changing their hair for a role, like I just would not have believed you. But here we are.
Empowertizing. There's a new word that you have come up with to add to our lexicon. But it goes actually back. It goes back to Virginia Slims and all that. You can trace it. There's been a kind of genealogy.
Oh, yeah. It goes back to, you know, the early part of the 20th century when cigarette companies were realizing that they had this entire new market to capitalize on. And, you know, suddenly it was being pitched to women that smoking would make them equal. And it's certainly just gone on from there. I mean, as long as there have been feminist movements, there have been industries looking to capitalize on them.
What's that word, empowertizing? Maybe we should define it.
So empowertizing is basically using kind of the language and the imagery and the associations that have been kind of that have come out of feminist movements. You know, whether it's standing up to the beauty myth or, you know, owning your power, owning your sexuality, and sort of harnessing them in the service of capitalism. So an example I use in the book is the Dove campaign for real beauty, which is this series of ads campaigns that have been going on for more than 10 years now that are really, you know, encouraging women to feel good about themselves, not be made to feel insecure or ashamed of their bodies. But at the same time, Dove is still selling them on remedies for problems that they might not even have known existed until Dove told them so.
You also use some examples of products that, again, uses female empowerment and yet have chemicals and kinds of ingredients that are not necessarily going to be useful to women?
For sure. And I mean, Dove is also a good example of this because they're owned by the multinational parent company Unilever, which is very well known for selling lightening creams to women across Southeast Asia. So, you know, it's a pretty massive disconnect there. You know, make your skin lighter so you can conform to this global Caucasian beauty standard. But then over here with Dove, feel good about yourself and embrace your unique beauty.
But this feel-good notion and this commodification of feminism, you feel to a great extent diverts women from the real things that they should be involved in, which in many cases don't feel good because they're tough battles.
Right. And I think that's the appeal of marketplace feminism and empowertizing is that they allow us to feel like, you know, we have come a long way. They really do kind of shift the frame of feminism to individual empowerment rather than the deeply entrenched systemic issues that, yeah, are not sexy, they're not fun, and they're not really sellable.
But doesn't this commodification also give a huge marketing campaign for a message that needs to get out that and that is positive?
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's sort of my own conundrum with it and partly why I wanted to write this book is that I feel like media and pop culture are such a fertile space of kind of opening eyes and consciousness raising. And so I think the trick really is critical thinking and talking about the difference between feminism that's being used to sell you something and feminism that's, you know, really about unfinished projects that affect everyone.
So you have examples, a lot of popular culture examples. I mean, some of it's celebrities, Beyonce, Taylor Swift, but also somebody like Sheryl Sandberg, you mentioned, with Lean In or Lena Dunham, Amy Schumer, the kinds of things that they do, which essentially are, you know, you go girl type of stuff or, you know, giving women what they think is an empowerment when indeed you seem to suggest that in juxtaposition with all of the issues that women should be concerned with and really ought to be fighting for, they may be get them, like I say, divert them. They get them away from those issues.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends because it's not really the same across the board. I think that Amy Schumer, for instance, is really brilliant in the way that she's able to take very uncomfortable concepts that are created that are related to media literacy, like what we expect from funny women versus funny men. And she makes them very accessible. She makes them very funny. And she sort of, interrogates her own position within them. I think Lena Dunham, to some extent, does the same thing. I think with Sheryl Sandberg, certainly there's an opportunity lost there, which is the opportunity to talk about who doesn't get to lean in and who is, when women are leaning in and becoming empowered and reaching these highest echelons of corporate life. What about the women who are making that life possible for them? You know, what about the nannies? What about the housekeepers? Where's their liberation going to come from?
Maybe we're talking about class differences. Ultimately, that was the feeling I got in reading a lot of your book. And I mean that in the best sense. I mean, you talk, for example, about a debate about female pubic hair, and you almost suggest this is privileged bourgeois kind of debate. It doesn't filter down or even go down to people who are like the nannies and the housekeepers and people who are on the workforce. It's almost like a kind of luxury.
Yeah. And I do think that where you find a lot of this kind of marketplace feminism debate is kind of in the knowledge industries, among writers and advertisers and creative classes who have the privilege and the luxury to really think and argue about these things more than, say, the women who are working two jobs just trying to get by. And, it's not really occurring to them like, I'm being told that my pubic hair can be a site of pivotal liberation.
Feminism, I come away, according to Annie Zeiser, is hard work. It's collective work. It's rolling up the sleeves. And it's not necessarily... although I'm sure you're not against people feeling good, but it's not necessarily feeling good in the way that, Madison Avenue makes people think they're going to feel good, right?
Right. And I feel like this is a larger thing. This is a larger issue of sort of our neoliberal society. We have become really down on collectivism in the past, couple of decades. We have started to really look down on the communal. Just think of Barack Obama being somehow accused of being a community organizer as though that's a bad thing.
I wasn't accused of that. I think it was more like that shouldn't necessarily prepare you to be president of the United States. And one could say the same about, running a huge operation the way Trump does. I mean, these are arguments of
right.
a different sort.
But it's true. I mean, we do have this. We're living in this society that really puts so much emphasis on the individual over the collective. And there's this attitude of, if I have an umbrella, it's not raining. And so I think we're definitely seeing that kind of creep into social movements. And certainly feminism is one place where that has absolutely happened, where we've really treated the sort of personal liberation of individual women as somehow signifying the liberation of all women. And that's a dangerous thing to do.
Well, you use language that suggests that danger. When you talk about market feminism, you even use the analogy of the Stockholm syndrome, as if, women are being taken in by this and taken in a way that, I'll use Blake's language, mind-forged manacles.
Right. And, by saying Stockholm syndrome, I really don't mean to suggest that women can't tell the difference between what's sort of shameless commercial pitches versus sort of actual on the ground feminism as like a living ethic. But I do think, we are consumers. We're encouraged to consume. And in that way, marketplace feminism makes a lot of sense. But I think it's really important, again, to just sort of keep critical thinking at the forefront and to really question whether marketplace feminism is truly progressive and equality focused, or whether we end up doing the work of corporations for them.
When you talk, though, about collectivism, you're really talking about issues that you believe, it comes across in your writing, should be centerpieces of feminist discourse and of feminist action. I'm talking about abuse of women, about the kind of – we just had a discussion about hatred online with sports journalists, women sports journalists. You know, stuff has been running rampant. These are the kind of issues that I think you're suggesting are being co-opted by what you call market feminism.
Yeah. And again, in some cases it's co-option. In other cases, it's just really drowning out because, again, it is so much easier to talk about the things that are sort of right in front of us that we see every day, that are within pop culture, that celebrities are talking about. It's much easier to look at those than to look at the people and the issues that are being erased from our most prominent conversations.
I'm sorry, please finish.
I was going to say, and part of this is just, you know, part of this is media economics. Part of this is the fact that there's so much more media out there than there was even 10 years ago. And there's a lot of clickbait. There are a lot of media organizations that are really clamoring for our eyeballs by kind of ramping up the most sensational, grabby aspects of these discourses.
I wonder what you think about celebrities, Miley Cyrus would be a good example, who talk about feminism as a right to be sexy. But what that means in many cases is you have a lot of talk about empowerment by showing off bodies or dressing in a sexy way. And this is supposed to be a feminist act?
Yeah. And I mean, this is not, you know, this didn't start with Miley Cyrus. This has been, you know, a feature of feminist movements for a while. I think, yeah, that can get into dicey territory because feminism is still such an unfinished project in the larger world. So where Miley Cyrus sees taking off her clothes and, you know, riding in on a wrecking ball as a feminist act, there's a critical mass of people who are still going to judge her and any woman, especially a young woman who does that. Very harshly. And then when you bring in the kind of racial double standards around that, it gets very dicey because Miley Cyrus and Taylor Swift, who's not quite as openly sexual, but still, we sort of take what they say as face value. When they say, I'm feminist, I'm empowered by my body, we tend to accept that. But when someone like Beyonce does it, or Nicki Minaj or Rihanna, there's a much harsher level of judgment that has a lot to do with race and has a lot to do with stereotypes about presentation and respectability and all those things. So it's not a clear conversation in any way. I think it's worth talking about. But again, as with all of these sort of marketplace feminist conversations, it can't end there. It has to sort of look at all the other connections.
Well, since you're making a connection to race, I couldn't help thinking about halftime at the Super Bowl when Beyonce was out there doing this whole number that was associated with the Black Panther movement and militancy and, you know, fighting the good fight, as many see it, against police brutality and all of that. It was a different kind of co-option, but it may also be seen in the same light. Or is it raising consciousness?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I feel distinctly unqualified to speak to that, but I have read a lot of really great writing on both that performance of Formation and then her recent Lemonade album, which very, very explicitly deals with, you know, Black women and power and race. I guess it comes down to the raising consciousness versus selling something question comes down to who's benefiting.
It can be a thin line.
Yeah. Sure. Yes. Beyonce has, you know, is building a brand on being very conscious and very sort of socially progressive. But she's just selling Beyonce. She's not like a global corporation that's trying to sell products to women that are sort of actively harming them.
Well, you also, getting back to sex for a moment, which always makes ears perk up and all that, but you write about like Rolling Stone and the magazine and say that there haven't been many women on the covers who aren't in their underwear, and that in itself says something very profound about the nature of the culture in terms of feminism. I mean, are these women, you know, showing their bodies in a feminist way and being free and independent and all that, or are they being essentially taken advantage of and objectified? And maybe it's both?
Yeah, I think it's both. And, you know, this has been such a long-running, you know, kind of terrible joke of ours at Bitch. Like, who's, you know, if there's a woman on the cover, what's she wearing? What underwear is she wearing? What's covering her breasts? Is it a guitar? Is it a songbook? What is it? I really feel like the discussion about these things should be less about individuals and more about systems. And certainly rock music and rock journalism is a system that has been deeply entrenched for decades.
This is all systemic. It's all institutional.
Yeah, it's all systemic. So, you know, I'm not crazy about questions like, is this particular woman empowering herself or is she being taken advantage of? It's more like, why is she being told that there are these limited routes to becoming famous and successful? And that, you know, at the top of the list is leveraging her sexuality or taking off her clothes or, you know, like, why is that so high on the list when it's really not high on the list for her male counterparts?
Talking with Andy Zeisler, who is co-founder of Bitch Media and also the author of We Were Feminists Once, From Riot Girl to Cover Girl and the Buying and Selling of a Political Movement. And we're going to get you, our listeners, of course, involved in this. She writes about Riot Girls into Spice Girls, and there are all kinds of metamorphoses here. But when we're talking about actually the marketplace sanitizing and, I'll use your language, diluting and repackaging radicalism, or you call it collectivism. So how do you redeem feminism? How do you bring it back?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I don't know that feminism needs to be redeemed because, as I said earlier, it is happening. It is happening in huge ways. You know, certainly online, on college campuses, at a grassroots level.
These are new waves. I mean, the waves
are
changing.
Some of them are new waves, yeah, but also some of them are incredibly not new because so many of the same issues are still issues. But yeah, certainly, you know, new populations, new generations are taking up the mantle every few years and doing different things and using different tools. So that's there. I'm not worried about that. I speak on college campuses a lot, and I am profoundly inspired by the young people. And it's not just women. It's men. It's genderqueer folks who are really looking for feminism in ways that, you know, maybe 20 years ago people weren't looking at feminism. You know, they're looking at through the lens of immigration and prison reform and things like that.
So. You should mention you were teaching at Columbia, in fact, I believe, weren't you at one point?
No, I wasn't. I gave I did a lecture there. And again, like just very, I mean, you know, I'm 43 years old and I have no fear that feminism is still really kicking.
Well, let's hear about, well, the fears and hopes and other kind of emotions from our listeners. Let me invite you to join this conversation. Feminism should be a movement, not a brand. So argues Bitch Media co-founder Andy Zeisler. She's here with us in studio and like to hear from you. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us now. Again, 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and in her new book, We Were Feminists Once, Andy Zeisler argues that modern feminism is less about beliefs and identity, more about products and celebrities. And she's with us to discuss this hour, the commercialization of feminism and what it means for women. She'll be at Book Passage in San Francisco tonight at 6 p.m. And you are certainly welcome to join this conversation. You can join us now by calling in toll-free, 866-733-6786, or emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai, has put out the question on our Facebook page, and you can respond to it by calling or emailing or going to our website. What is feminism 2016? And simply fill in the blank. 2016, what is feminism to you? We're going to go to your calls in just a moment here. And I wanted to just bring up one other thing before we do that with you, Andy, and that is The candidacy of Secretary or Senator Clinton, Hillary Rodham Clinton, there's certainly a lot of gender activity and signification of one sort or another around her candidacy and, you know, special place in hell for women who don't support a woman as candidate, all that kind of response from Madeleine Albright and others. Is there, do you think, a kind of ideation of, well, I'm a feminist because I'm working on behalf of a woman to be president of the United States, or I'm voting for a woman to be president of the United States, that gets crystallized into I'm a feminist?
I don't know. I mean, I certainly among the women I know who are leaning toward voting for Hillary, it's not because they sort of unequivocally think that she is the most feminist candidate that they can imagine, but it's more that they are aware of how qualified she is and how much her gender has really impacted her entire political journey, from when she was first lady, from when she was senator, to, you know, her first presidential bid in 2008. It is this sense, not that, you know, we're voting or they're voting blindly for a woman because she happens to share their gender, but because they're really very, very aware of how gender circumscribes women's abilities to be heard and be respected and have their accomplishments and their skills acknowledged on their own merits.
Well, let me say, without any kind of partisanship here or support for her candidacy or anything like that, I thought she gave a very reasonable and thoughtful response when she was asked. I believe it was Before the Iowa primary, you know, about should women vote for you just to have historically a woman as a president? She said, no, they should vote for me based on, you know, my qualifications and based on what I believe I bring to the table, which was certainly the right, I think by many people's lights, the right thing to say. We, as I said, asked our listeners on social media to complete this thought. In 2016, feminism is, and let me just give you a little sampling of some of the responses so far. Olivia says, in 2016, feminism is empowerment. Kate writes, it's rad. Sharon tweets, it's necessary. And another listener writes, in 2016, feminism is cancer. The whole range there. Let's go to our callers. And let's go first to Redwood City. Annalise, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to say I'm 22 and about to graduate from college, and I think the commercialization of feminism has made it a lot more accessible to people in my demographic. I spent last night talking about Beyonce and Formation and her upcoming concert and kind of what it means to us and her theme of empowerment. And even though there are some things that marketing feminism, you know, has done and, you know, has maybe upset some people who have really been supporters for a long time, I think that for younger girls, it's made it a lot easier to become a part of and to open up that conversation.
Well, do you think, though, Annalise, that some of that popular culture, whether it's Lemonade or whatever, is maybe taking you and young women your age or in your age group away from more serious issues, you know, health care for low-income women or violence against women, those kinds of things?
You know, I'm an optimist, and I would just hope that it would kind of get us talking about those issues, and as we get older and as we join the workplace and start to experience some of those things for ourselves, I hope that we have that experience, understanding empowerment through pop culture to really stand up for ourselves in terms of healthcare or, you know, wage equality and, you know, other things like that.
Okay. Let me thank you for the call.
We'll go
to some more calls in a moment, but here's a tweet from Michelle who says, in 2016, feminism is back, and not because of Hillary. Dominant culture seemed to have lost interest, but the rest of us didn't. And I want to go to more of your calls here. Let me get Daryl on from Berkeley. Daryl, you're on.
Hi. I just would like to hear her comments on the sort of tension as an African-American woman that I feel between the current issues of the day, including the Black Lives Matter movement and modern-day feminist activism and gender identity movement. I feel like there's a lot of issues coming up out of the election and around Hillary, where you see Hillary supporters basically pressuring anybody who is female, including Black women, to embrace her wholeheartedly without her having actually shown much interest in addressing the issues that are, or even apologizing for the actions that were taken during the 90s in the Clinton era. And I also just think that people didn't seem to notice what was going on when the Voting Rights Act was decimated because everyone was so busy celebrating about gender equity or marriage equity. There just seemed to be a lot of issues kind of arising around tensions between African-American issues of the day and or civil rights issues of the day outside of feminism. So I'd like to know how she sees that being addressed through, you know, feminism becoming a more intersectional and equitable movement that's not just kind of focused on middle class and upper middle class white women.
Yeah, thank you, Daryl. Let's go to Andy Zeisler. Andy?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, and there's so much there that is absolutely a legacy of feminism that that we haven't fully reckoned with. And again, this comes down to the idea that feminism has been really filtered through the media in many ways to really be, yes, about the kind of personal liberation of white middle class women. That said, again, this is one of the places where I don't think marketplace feminism really reflects the tenor of the intersectional, very, very nuanced, very race conscious, very gender conscious feminism that you see, for instance, online. There's nothing in marketplace feminism that can compare to the level or the complexity of dialogue, for instance, that I see on Twitter among women of color talking about these issues, talking about Hillary Clinton, talking about that very question of why should we support this candidate who has not adequately, you know, said anything about how our issues fit into her agenda.
Let me thank you for the call, Daryl. And there's a comment from a listener named Charles who says, it's really funny how you speak like there is one way of being a feminist. It's sad that being a feminist often sounds like rejecting beauty and being more male. Feminists are super judgmental and hold a limited way of looking at women.
That that is a familiar argument often that I hear from people who really come to feminism with their own sort of set of beefs that really I don't believe are reflected in most of the feminism that I see out there. And again, this is one of those things that I, you know, maybe he'll read this book, maybe he won't. But this is absolutely something I do talk about, the fact that feminism is not about being judgmental. It's certainly not about rejecting beauty standards. It is about really negotiating what it means to buy into those things in a world that is still, you know, I hate to use the P word, but very patriarchal.
Well, you mentioned the beauty myth, and I thought, of course, of Naomi Wolf, and there was a real argument that she formed about commercialization and commodification of women as objects of beauty, which, you know, caused a great deal of pain and obviously suffering among women who didn't meet those standards. And, you know, it's a kind of foregone conclusion that that's been an ongoing struggle for many women and continues to be. I'm just interested, though, in finding out. I mean, you talk a lot about choice. And, you know, women can choose to pubic hair, not pubic hair, underarm hair, leg hair, you know, all these kinds of issues that, as you say, may be among the more privileged. But they also are being empowered, quote unquote, by the sales tactics, which make them think that they have the choice to do things and that that choice is somehow tied to consumer products.
Right. And that's sort of that's kind of the trap of consumer empowerment, is that we have this fairly limited range of choices that overall still very much align with expectations for, you know, feminine attractiveness, sort of performative beauty and sexuality, and the idea that we are not necessarily autonomous people, but we are, you know, there for other people to consume and for other, you know, entities to make money off of. So that can be very difficult because we all know that there is a societal benefit to conforming to beauty standards. Certainly, you know, I'm guilty of that as well. But the fact is, what we should be asking is why, again, why is that such a limited range of choices and ones that in many cases men are not expected to make, for instance, in service to their careers or, you know, their education or things like that?
Well, we're actually looking at a question about men being feminists here. Dan says, as you're guessing, feminism is a discussion of both women and men. Many feminists feel feminism and related discussions are solely women's domain and men should just listen and wait for what emerges. And the fact of the matter is, feminism has been very much a part of many men's lives, including my own, and continues to be. I mean, this concerns all of us ought to concern all of us. A lot of the issues we're talking about, particularly when you get into the issues that are certainly primary to you, incarceration of women and poor women not having equal opportunities and so forth. But, you know, it's objectification of people that also affects both genders and needs to be seen in that light, it seems to me.
Oh, absolutely.
Another listener says, doesn't the branding of feminism allow access to ideas of feminism without actually having to be in a group? In these times of individualism and alienation, this kind of access seems to be the only way the ideas can remain alive.
You know, I think that's that's understandable. To me, that's a little bit of a cynical way to look at it, because brands are not our friends. You know, they're not interested. They're not in the social movement business. You know, they're not in the progressive business. They're in the making money business. It's true that, you know, there is a way in which it's possible for, you know, discussions about empowerment or discussions about self-determination to kind of sort of creep out of those brand messages. But you could certainly just as easily say that about, just even reading a book.
I'll bet you, though, that there are some women who work in this media capacity, you know, trying to sell a product and everything else, who really feel they're doing good by this. They're raising levels of consciousness.
Oh, yeah. And this this idea of femvertising, which is a hashtag that was coined sort of within the ad industry over the past few years, there's been a massive sort of groundswell of support within the ad industry and certainly among female ad executives who really do feel like this is a bold new move of not insulting women with advertising. And I guess you could say that that's progress, but it's also a pretty low bar.
And here's Joyce from Stanford. Joyce, welcome. You're on the air.
Oh, great. Thank you. First, I'm really enjoying this conversation. I pulled off the road so I could ask you this question. I'm going to buy your book. I think you're very smart, and I'm enjoying this. I'm curious to know what you think about the fact that most supporters think that Hillary Clinton is dishonest and untrustworthy when you look at the polls. And in part, this is something that the Sanders campaign has been, pushing. And I personally feel that this is a bit sexist, and I'm wondering what you think about that. I'm also wondering what you think about her inability to reach young women.
Yeah, well, so to the first question, when we get to this level of politics, when we get to this presidential level, I don't even know if trustworthiness is a metric we should be leaning on, because we're talking about politics, we're talking about compromise, we're talking about a system that, you know, a two-party system that is pretty broken. And I think there's a lot of validity to the Sanders campaign's criticisms of Hillary Clinton. I wouldn't say that the sexism there is anything like the sexism that's being lobbed her way by the Trump campaign, certainly. But I do think there's a sense among a certain very radical group of Sanders supporters that Hillary represents, a completely sort of corrupted evil that sort of goes beyond gender.
And well, so, I think one of the reasons that Ted Cruz in his final gasps decided to have a running mate in Carly Fiorina was that she could go up against Hillary and, you know, you could have a a battle of the women there. And in fact, I'm looking at a listener's question who says, what are your thoughts on what seems to be a trend of political stunt casting, making women vice presidential running mates?
Oh, yeah. I mean, certainly Sarah Palin in 2008, that was just a transparently cynical move. And of course, it, you know,
backfired
spectacularly. Yeah. And that, you know, a lot of that does have to do with this idea among political strategists that women will vote for a woman based on their shared gender, which is bizarre because, you know, we're more than 50% of the population. We're not all the same thing. We don't have a hive mind. But I do think that the Carly Fiorina pick was the same kind of last gasp grab at that.
But this idea of women solidarity, that you're, because Hillary Clinton is running or Carly Fiorina is running, they're going to draw more women. That may be true to an extent, but some of the most vicious and vile comments of the trolls are from women trolls.
That's
about candidates like that.
That's true. I mean, you know, I certainly think that there is a lot of, you know, women have internalized a lot of misogyny. That's not new. And that's certainly, we're seeing a lot of that.
Also, read a comment from Beth who says, Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In, stresses empowerment of women, yet look at Facebook and most high-tech firms. They have mostly men in all positions. Seems to me we need to call out the feminist women who are simply giving lip service to empowering women. And let me go to more calls. We'll go next to Menlo Park. Greg, you're on. Morning.
Hi. So, okay. You know, my question, I have two questions. It's firstly, what's it going to take for this discussion around empowerment to shift? Have we been scared too much out of a collective way of discussing it into an individual way? You know, what's it going to take for us to kind of shift back into a more collective sense of empowerment? Is that an issue? And secondly, how, you know, university environments, they have organizations and such for these that create these type of spaces for speaking of these issues. So what, for a college-aged person like me, how might I be able to sort of embody this? I don't mean to ask, you know, it's like, how might I be able to embody these types of ideas in my sort of everyday life, my interactions at work and such? You know, what are the spaces besides just online blogging about this?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to speak to the first question about sort of what's it going to take to sort of get to a place where it's less about individuals and more about, you know, people and collective movements. I mean, I think a lot of it is really removing this idea that feminism is some kind of zero-sum game, that what benefits women must take away from men. You know, I think, you know, as you said, Michael, there's always been this, you know, feminism is for everyone. What liberates women from unrealistic expectations and assumptions also liberates men. If we can get rid of the kind of scarcity mentality that says there's only so much liberation to go around, then I think we're getting somewhere. And then I think we can kind of refocus on what's good for everyone.
But I recall when there was a lot of emphasis in feminist thinking on, with certainly duly understood at the time, with women establishing agency and their own autonomy and pretty much moving toward careers, really, breaking glass ceilings, etc. And the reality was that many women felt encumbered by this. They felt, you know, they wanted to be wives and mothers, and yet that didn't seem good enough according to a lot of the feminist ideologues or according to the messages they were getting at the time. There's still really that kind of split, isn't there?
I think so. And a part of this is, again, this is an unfinished project of feminism, that when women are doing it all, you know, and I'm putting doing it all in air quotes, they really are doing it all because the expectations, particularly on the domestic front, in, you know, heterosexual marriages with wives and mothers, there is still the expectation that women are, in addition to everything else, kind of bearing the brunt of all that. That dynamic has not shifted enough to really to make it equal enough. There's a lot of studies out there that suggest that women are still, you know, working that second shift.
Again, Andy Zeisler is the author of We Were Feminists Once and Second Shift. The author is Arlie Hochschild, who's local here.
Sin, your book, Susie Bright's a friend of yours? Or
yeah.
She gave you a plug.
She did.
She used to live here and, of course, was well-known to many of us. Let me get another caller on, though. Emily, thank you for waiting. You're on.
Hi. I'm calling to ask and make a few statements. I am a stay-at-home mother. I chose that as a supplement to my career path. Now, I have a question pertaining to women and femininity. And that is, sometimes I feel like, as a woman, I am made to feel like I have to choose between femininity and feminism, meaning I chose to stay at home, and so some feminist activists see that as backpedaling, and I just was wanting to hear what your guest has to say about stay-at-home moms.
Now, thank you for that, Emily. We just touched on it. Let's go into more depth with you, Andy Zeisler, on that, if we could.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it really does come down to, you know, it's less about free choices in a lot of ways and more about what can families actually afford to do. You know, making that choice isn't an option for so many women. I'm a mother and I couldn't be a stay-at-home mother. It doesn't mean that I don't feel like that would be great for a little while. But I think the reality for most women is that it's not really one or the other. They do both at different times in their lives for different reasons. I think the controversy and the sort of what are called the mommy wars are something that in many ways have been a media construction of anti-feminists to pit women against one another, again, to shift focus from the things that haven't changed. You know, when we're talking about stay-at-home mothers versus working mothers, what we're not talking about is why hasn't the distribution of housework changed? Why do we still expect everything from mothers and very, very little from fathers?
I'm looking at a tweet from a listener who says, feminism is not being accused of or being judged for voting for Hillary Clinton because I'm a woman. And Veronica emails, Andy, what role should media and advertising play in feminism?
That's a great question. you know, I think that It depends on the media. It depends on the advertising. I certainly think there are companies out there and advertising for those companies that really is making a concerted effort to not pander to women, not use the terms of empowerment to sort of make women feel good at the expense of really understanding that they're being peddled to. I think the role of media and advertising is to really look at the reality of women and not just at the bottom line.
And again, we asked the question of listeners in 2016, feminism is, and Avi writes, 2016, feminism is activism. And we're going to go to another caller here. Let me get you on, Dina. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi there. Some of what I was going to say has already sort of been covered, but basically there's female and there's feminine. We have males, we have females, but feminine is a quality that can exist in both males and females, and I think the more important quality has to be humanism. You have to really educate men, but you have to educate women. You have to make sure that people understand that the qualities we need to have so that everyone has respect for everyone else has nothing to do with whether you're female or male. It has to do with whether or not you embody both the yin and the yang, so you have a balanced society with balanced thinking and balanced emotional approaches to life.
Well, that's certainly good sentiments, and Dina, thank you for those. It also prompts me to ask, since she said, you know, feminine is a good quality, and it's often associated with, in many people's minds, something that feminists don't have. I'm thinking about somebody like, dare to say the name, Rush Limbaugh, who was talking about feminazis at one point and everything. In other words, the implication that that those who call themselves feminists take on, you know, a rough identity and are rough-hued and rough around their edges, and they're certainly not feminine.
Right. Well, again, this is one of those really, really sticky, long-standing media myths that has been used to discredit feminism by accusing feminism of wanting to dominate men, accusing feminists of wanting to supplant men, when really that's a very, very fractional number of feminists. Most feminists are not necessarily interested in being better than men. They want the same opportunities, the same rights, and the same liberties. It doesn't really have anything to do with their presentation as feminism. It has to do with their rights. But it's a very easy tactic to say, well, you know, you just want to be a man. So, yeah.
Another listener, Adam, says, what's feminism like in the religious world? Do you have any idea, Andy, how that works? I mean, the more religious, probably the less feminism.
You know, it's really interesting. I have a good friend who used to be a Bay Area resident, Danya Ruttenberg, and she's a rabbi. And she has written extensively about feminism within Judaism, as have a number of other, you know, women in Judaism. Mormon feminism has become incredibly prominent in the sort of social media age. I think that there are really fascinating conversations to be had there that are sort of beyond the scope of the marketplace, because they really are about, at base, religious autonomy and sexual autonomy and, you know, humanism within religions that are traditionally very patriarchal.
Andy Zeisler, good to have you with us on Forum. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Her book, again, is We Were Feminists Once, From Riot Girl to Cover Girl, The Buying and Selling of a Political Movement. And she'll be at Book Passage again in San Francisco tonight at 6 p.m. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion online. In fact, we encourage you to do that by going to kqed.org/forum. And we'll be back with you on the morrow. If all goes according to plan, we're going to be talking with a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist who was a Vietnam refugee. And behind the scenes here, Forum's producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauberg. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and general manager, Joanne Wallace. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.